welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note to indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. In this Hoosier bicentennial year, Andrea Neal is especially busy. She's been working on a series of newspaper columns, Indiana at 200, celebrating the top 100 historic events, figures, and ideas in Indiana history. The series has been adapted for broadcast by WIPB Television and Indiana Public Radio. Now there's a book just in time for summer. It is Road Trip, A Pocket History of Indiana, published by Indiana Historical Society Press. We visited Andrea's Indianapolis home and asked, how did all this get started?
I would say it was 2013 I got the idea to do a column on Indiana history for the bicentennial, and that the column would lead up really over the course of several years educating Hoosiers about our past. And I approached Craig Loudwick at Indiana Policy Review, and he said, yeah, we'll distribute your column to newspapers all around the state. And so actually starting July of 2013, the column began, and I started with the Ice Age, because James Madison in his Indiana history book starts Indiana history with the Ice Age. If it's good enough for James Madison, it's good enough for me. And I just picked what I thought were the top 100 events, figures, places in Indiana history. With one caveat, they had to have a destination attached, because I wanted Hoosiers to be able to go and live and see and breathe the spot where Hoosier history happened. In a few instances, I settled for a historic marker, but that was always a last gasp if I just couldn't find a better place to visit. But I wanted Hoosiers to get out and about and see Indiana. So then I approached the Historical Society and said, hey, I'm writing this column on Indiana history. Would you have any interest in taking them, compiling them into a book? And to my great fortune, they said yes.
The Ice Age is actually a great place to start because it had such an effect on Indiana's geography.
Certainly the top two-thirds of the state it had an effect on. As geologists quickly told me, don't say all of Indiana, because the bottom third is not a result of Ice Age events. People think Indiana is flat. Indiana is not flat. The Ice Age is part of the reason. And if you drive around and see some of the hilly spots, it's pretty impressive. That whole process of ice retreating and water gushing over the land has really done some interesting things to our topography.
Well, and one of the fun places that you talked about, I think, is Devil's Backbone.
Boy, that's almost scary. There's some sheer drop-off on either side. This is right next to Shades State Park, and you can take a heck of a hike. It's a couple miles, and you can see what I would call cliffs. Yes, we have cliffs in Indiana. You can see water because two creeks converge there, and you can stand in a rather harrowing spot and look down.
And I guess if you were looking at the state's past in that way, you might want to stop down by Louisville near the Falls of the Ohio, right?
Yes. So if I could start over again, I would actually start my book during the Devonian Age because of the wonderful fossil beds that you can see down there. I do make reference to them in connection with a few other columns, but that's quite a historic place as well.
So much of the state's history is about the unique personalities, the people who helped shape Indiana.
Wow, there were so many Hoosier characters I fell in love with. I always knew who Lew Wallace was, but I didn't know I loved him. Boy, that gentleman could do everything. In fact, he reminds me of Thomas Jefferson because of his wide range of interests. He was interested in architecture and books and nature and reading. And of course, he was a lawyer and a statesman and a Civil War general and wrote one of the best-selling books of all time, Ben-Hur, which, by the way, a new movie version is coming out this August.
In our bicentennial year, there are some don't-miss places and spaces that you'd want to see.
There's so many, I don't really know where to start. If you like nature, I would start with the state parks, which are, as you know, one of the great legacies of our centennial. And the state park system is celebrating its centennial. As the state celebrates its bicentennial, I would recommend going to Clifty Falls on one end of the state and then going up to the dunes on the other and really getting to see all that Indiana's nature has to offer.
Remind us about that. The state park system
was one of the results of the centennial celebration. There were pageants everywhere in 1916. Every community put on festivals and fairs and programs to educate Hoosiers about our first 100 years. But as thanks to Richard Lieber and a few other good folks, we developed a state park system, which is really a taste of what Indiana looks like in all its various forms. Great places to hike, lodges to spend the night in. If it's the winter, places to even go cross-country skiing. And so the state park system is something special. So I would not miss the state parks, or at least pick one of them to visit. Then there are other places. So Indiana history mirrors U.S. history. For every important story in American history, there's an Indiana story that matches up. The American Revolution, George Rogers Clark, and the George Rogers Clark Memorial would be one example. And what many Hoosiers don't understand is how instrumental he was in securing what would then have been the West for this, what was to be our new country, and pushing out the British. So I would begin maybe with the American Revolution. The War of 1812, you don't want to miss the Tippecanoe Battlefield near Lafayette, where Tecumseh's forces were defeated by General William Henry Harrison. Tecumseh wasn't there at the time. His brother, the Prophet, was. Tecumseh was down south recruiting Indians for his Confederacy. William Henry Harrison knew this, and he picked that moment. And that really was considered, one, the end to the Indian presence in Indiana, but two, it was the precursor to the War of 1812, when the United States said goodbye to the British for good. So I would go there. And then, of course, we have the Civil War, and you can follow along the John Hunt Morgan path in southern
Morgan's
Indiana.
Morgan's Raid.
Morgan's Raid, the one southern incursion onto Hoosier soil. And from there, as long as we're going on this war theme, you could go to the Indiana War Memorial. The basement has a gem of a museum, and you can learn about John Gresham, a Hoosier from Evansville who is believed to have been the first U.S. fatality of World War I. You can learn all about the other wars while you're there.
Andrea Neal, teacher at St. Richard's Episcopal School in Indianapolis and an adjunct scholar with Indiana Policy Review. She's finishing up her newspaper series, Indiana at 200, celebrating the state's history. She's got a new book, Road Trip, A Pocket History of Indiana, published by Indiana Historical Society Press.
Indiana Weekend, interesting people and places from across our region. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
Talking with author Andrea Neal, who is writing a series of 100 newspaper columns about Indiana history in recognition of this bicentennial year. Naturally, in talking about some of the state's interesting personalities, she mentioned the former president whose home on the north side of Indianapolis is an interesting stop. That would be, of course, Benjamin Harrison.
The only Hoosier president in that he was living in Indiana, a resident of Indiana at the time he was elected to the presidency. But Lincoln, we can sure claim Lincoln as a Hoosier since he lived in Indiana from ages 7 to 21, the most formative years. So he wasn't living in Indiana, he was living in Illinois, but we can claim him and William Henry. So we really have three presidents with connections to Indiana.
The Benjamin Harrison home is a place that people can tour, really learn about him. And
yes, at 16th and Delaware. I think most Hoosiers visit it when they're in fourth grade, and they think, been there, done that. But the reality is, I've been on multiple tours of that place, and each docent has a different passion or interest, and every tour is different. You can go to the Benjamin Harrison home as an adult, and it'll be all new from what you learned as a fourth grader, and I recommend it. In fact, Benjamin Harrison's legacy is being reevaluated. I could almost create an analogy to Alexander Hamilton and the way Hamilton, the musical, has caused us to reconsider Hamilton. As we look at Benjamin Harrison, yes, he was a one-term president. Yes, he was defeated by Grover Cleveland, whom he didn't even really defeat based on popular vote when he was elected. He was a pioneer. He advocated African-American rights. He advocated conservation. He set aside hundreds of thousands of acres of forest land in the western part of the country. He appointed Frederick Douglass, the first African-American to be ambassador to Haiti. He signed the Sherman Antitrust Act into law. For a one-term president, he actually was quite accomplished. He was not a stodgy old Republican as we think of, but he was actually a very progressive, intellectual Republican who was beholden to no one. Republican leaders didn't like him that much. And he did what he thought was right. He was a decent, honest man, and all Hoosiers should know more about him.
And you can stand on that street where he lived, and the campaign, didn't he campaign from his front porch?
Yes, the front porch doesn't look today like it would have then. He was not much of a campaigner, and so he didn't really leave much the confines of his home in Indianapolis. He was a second choice of most of the delegates that year to the convention. He was a compromise candidate at what you might call a brokered or contested convention, and nobody objected to him. That's how he became president, really.
Do you think that when a time like a state's bicentennial comes along, is there a fresh look at, do the historians and others open up the books again and say,
yes,
where are we?
That's exactly what's happened. Let's use James Madison, the preeminent Indiana historian, as a case in point. He had an earlier history called The Indiana Way, and he was updating it for the bicentennial. And I remember having a brief conversation with him when he was trying to decide what to call it. And because he thought it was just going to be a revision of the book. But he said, you know, I really rewrote the book. It's a new book. There's so many things that I've discovered that I didn't know then. History has changed so much. The way we look at events has changed so much. We've obviously incorporated a much better understanding into our history books of things like race relations, the thorny relationship Indiana had with the Ku Klux Klan in the 20th century, and these things are better reflected. So he gave his book a new title, and it's called A New History of Indiana. Other historians are doing this as well, of course, but he would be the most obvious example.
How about a region that we talk about, but a lot of folks don't get out to see what is in and around Lafayette and Grouseland, for example, and Lafayette is named for the Marquis de Lafayette.
Oh, I'd love to tell that story because this is a little told story in Indiana history. In 1824 and 25, the Marquis de Lafayette, who was so instrumental in helping the Americans win the Revolution against the British, came to the United States on what you could call sort of a final victory tour. He was aging. He loved the United States. He wanted to come back again and visit places he had seen when he had been here. He was, of course, a Frenchman. And he spent much of this victory tour on the East Coast, went to Mount Vernon, went to places where people he knew and loved had resided and met with officials there. But he also came to the interior, and he spent a substantial amount of time in Louisville. The Indiana General Assembly passed a resolution inviting him formally to come to visit Indiana. And it was only a day visit, but he crossed the Ohio River, went to Jeffersonville, where throngs met him. The women had been working for days preparing centerpieces of beautiful roses and other flowers that they put across a 210-foot table where they were to dine, and toasts were spread all around. It was just lovely, and if I might, Lafayette himself toasted the Hoosier State, saying, "May the rapid progress of this young state, a wonder among wonders, more and more evince the blessings of Republican freedom." And it was quite an affair. That was the time that Lafayette was founded, the same year. And the founder of Lafayette was a gentleman by the name of William Digby. And he so admired the Marquis de Lafayette that he decided to name Lafayette after him. So there's no place to visit in Jeffersonville, but you can go to Lafayette. And there's a wonderful sculpture of him there on the courthouse square.
Andrea Neal, a teacher, former newspaper editorial page editor, a good storyteller who's been writing about this year's Hoosier Bicentennial. Her new book is Road Trip, A Pocket History of Indiana, published by Indiana Historical Society Press. Good to have for those one-tank trips in the summer. Let's dance upon our
underneath sycamore tree, climb up through that canopy to see the Indiana sky.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
You know, talking about the character of a state, in every place, in every state, people feel as if, you know, there's a unique character. Indiana has sort of these cross currents, right? I mean, I think of Eugene Debs as an example.
Eugene Debs, certainly his story is sort of timely right now. He's been compared to Bernie Sanders. He ran for president many times, once from prison. He was a labor organizer. He was influential in the labor movement. One of the times he ran for president was from prison, and he still got something like a million votes. He was an example, I think, of this Hoosier individualism. I would say Hoosiers have a reputation as being conservative. I think that's erroneous. I think it's this love of individualism that really is what drives the individuals who have become famous in Indiana history. Eugene Debs would be a really good example, but I mean, if we look at Benjamin and William Henry Harrison, they would be examples as well. Others, Sherman Minton, Indiana Supreme Court Justice, he was a conservative guy, and yet he was influential in the Brown versus Board of Education ruling. He doesn't get credit for it, of course, but here's why he's influential. In 1952, the Brown versus Board appeal came to the United Supreme Court. Earl Warren wasn't on the court yet. It takes four votes to accept a case, to hear a case. A majority of the court, five members of the court, voted not to hear the Brown versus Board of Education case. Had it not been for Sherman Minton, one of the four votes to accept and hear the case, it's quite possible that issue would have been delayed for another day. So he does not get credit for that. Again, he believed in doing what was right. He, like I say, he was not known as a progressive or a liberal, but he thought through things independently as an individual, and I think that's the Hoosier way, if there is a Hoosier way.
And in downtown Indianapolis, you have the Minton Capehart Federal Building.
Yes, you can go to the State House and see Sherman Minton's bust, and he's remembered there. We probably don't do enough teaching our students about Sherman Minton. There are lots of Hoosiers who are like that, that we don't even realize how interesting they are until we study them. I was just at the Capitol building in Washington visiting with eighth grade students whom I teach. And of course, there are two Hoosiers who are remembered there in Statuary Hall. One we've already discussed, Lew Wallace. The other, Oliver P. Morton. Again, a Hoosier that we should remember because he was one of influential Civil War governor. He did what it took for Indiana to be solidly in the Union camp for President Lincoln at a time when many members of the Indiana legislature, in particular the Democratic members of the legislature, didn't want to provide funding to properly equip members of for preparation for the Army. So Oliver Morton said, you know what, we're doing it anyway. In fact, he didn't call the legislature into session at one point for fear that they would undermine his efforts.
On your way to recognizing the bicentennial, you wrote 100 newspaper columns. How many trips would you say you made out into the state?
About 80. Yeah, so, and but again, that's over the course of several years. And I tried to combine when I could. A few places I'd never been before. It never failed. I would go visit some little place and I would walk away saying, now that's Indiana's best kept secret. Delphi, I'd never been there, where they have this wonderful museum that remembers the canal era in Indiana, and when during the summer you can take a canal boat ride on a stretch of restored Wabash Erie Canal, everyone should go there. I'd actually never been to the Studebaker Museum in South Bend. That is one of the best museums I've ever visited. I never got car buffs. Who are these guys who collect old cars and keep them in their garages and spend thousands of dollars on it? After going to that museum, I understood those are works of art. Another comparable museum, the Auburn Cord Duesenberg Museum. Again, I saw so many cars. I combined those two trips. So many cars, my mind was reeling, but you can really learn a lot about Hoosier's love affair with the cars by going there. I recommend not only going to those two museums, but maybe stopping at a drive-in. You can go to Greenwood, Indiana, to the Suds. It is one of the oldest surviving drive-ins from the drive-in era, the 1950s. You've got an old station wagon on the book cover, the idea being, we love our cars. Let's jump in our cars this summer and drive around the state and see what there is. Of course, everyone knows the Indy 500 is what makes Indiana known around the globe. It's the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500 this year. And those two things are related. That's what many Hoosiers don't know. The Indianapolis 500 really didn't begin with the intent to become the greatest sporting event in the world. It began as a testing location for automobile technology. And we consumers, whether it's rear view mirrors or engine refinements, we have those founders of the Speedway to thank, because that was their idea. You would give a car makers a place to go and test their latest innovations against each other to see what was the best and the safest.
80 trips around the state to help tell the story of Indiana. Did you ever get lost?
Oh, now that's an interesting question. Thank goodness for GPS. There were a few places where my GPS didn't work. Metamora, where it's another canal era site where you can also ride a canal boat down there. That's a state historic site. It's pretty charming. But yeah, I drove around a bit because my GPS gave out on me.
Why Corydon as the first state capital? I mean, it wasn't in the center of the state. It's way down.
Right, but at that point, they knew when they picked Corydon that that would not be a permanent capital, and that would be a temporary location. It was more convenient than Vincennes, and many of the political leaders of the time were down there. They intended it just as a temporary spot until a committee was able to go on an expedition to find the perfect spot. And of course, they chose Indianapolis because, one, it was almost dead center geographically, but also there was a confluence of Fall Creek and White River, and they thought it might be convenient for water travel.
I remember the first time I drove to Indiana, watching fences in the distance fade away. Once there was a girl.
Andrea Neal, author of Road Trip, A Pocket History of Indiana, published by Indiana Historical Society Press. You can also catch her superb storytelling on the topic of Indiana history by Googling up her newspaper column, Indiana at 200. Be sure to search for that with her name, Andrea Neal, to find those essays in state newspapers, which, by the way, have also been adapted for use on WIPB television and right here at Indiana Public Radio. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft, and all the folks in the front office, including your friends Matt Bloom, Connie Clary, Lori Georgie, Emily Kowalski, Andrea Lutz, John Morgan, Angie Rapp, and Debbie Webb. Glad you could join us this time. Hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.